Well, good afternoon to everyone. Good to see everybody here. I would like to begin, if we could all turn to Luke chapter 17. Luke chapter 17. Three words by Jesus Christ that are very important. And Jesus Christ says in verse 32 of Luke 17, "Remember Lot's wife." Now, to remember something means it's important. If you told your wife, "Remember to put gas in the car before you leave," I mean, that's important. If you said to someone, "Remember to pick up little Johnny at school or little Susie," that's important. If you can't do it, if you tell someone to remember to do it for you, that's important. If you say to your spouse, "Remember to pay the electric bill, it's due. Remember to pay it," it's important. So when Jesus Christ says, "Remember Lot's wife," that's important. But the dichotomy is that we know next to nothing about Lot's wife. We don't even know her name. And you know that this is the only place in the entire New Testament where she's mentioned. Just three words. This passage is like an iceberg. Because with an iceberg, there's much more under the surface than what we see above the surface of the water. And it's no different with this passage. It forces us to dig. What are the lessons for us? That's what I want to look at today. If you turn back to Genesis 19, which is the only other place in all of the Old Testament where Lot's wife is mentioned, there are only four scriptures in the entire Bible that refer to Lot's wife. And yet, Christ said, "Remember her." A little backdrop before we get into Genesis 19. In Genesis 18, and beginning in verse 16, we find the decision and the reason why Sodom and Gomorrah had to be destroyed. And in Genesis 18, beginning in verse 16, we read, "Then the men rose from there and looked toward Sodom, and Abraham went with them to send them on their way. And the Lord said, 'Shall I hide from Abraham what I'm doing? Since Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed.'" And verse 20, God says to him, "Because the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and because their sin is very grave, I will go down now and see whether they have done altogether according to the outcry against it that has come to me. And if not, I will know." So the reports that were coming to God about Sodom and Gomorrah were so awful, were so terrible, that God wanted to come down and see it for himself. To see if how can this be true? And after hearing and seeing, this is what the verdict would be. Genesis 19, we'll look ahead. In verse 13, the angels said to Lot, "For we will destroy this place." This is Genesis 19, 13. "Because the outcry against them has grown great before the face of the Eternal, and the Eternal has sent us to destroy it." What a decision to make for God, that it is so bad that he has to get rid of it and destroy it completely. So with that, we come to Genesis 19, and we're going to look at this story. Always with the back of our mind, what we're going to learn, what we can glean from Lot's wife. So Genesis 19 and verse 1, "Now the two angels came to Sodom in the evening, and Lot was sitting in the gate of Sodom. When Lot saw them, he rose to meet them, and he bowed himself with his face to the ground. And he said, 'Hear now, my lords, please turn into your servant's house, spend the night, wash your feet, that you may arise early and go on your way.' And they said, 'No, but we will spend the night in the open square.' But he, in verse 3, insisted strongly, probably assumed that they didn't know how bad things were in Sodom and Gomorrah. Probably he assumed they didn't know. He thought they were, if they were going to spend the night in the square, Lot probably thought to himself, boy, what's going to happen to these fellows? Because this town is an awful town. So they turned into him and entered his house. Then he made them a feast and baked unleavened bread, and they ate. What I find interesting is that Lot's wife is not involved at all. She does nothing. He does the cooking. He does the entertaining. Now before they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, both old and young, all the people from every quarter surrounded the house. What's interesting is that it wasn't just the adults. There were young individuals that were surrounding that house. And they weren't there to say hello. They weren't there to greet these guests of Lot. We'll find out in a moment what their intentions were. And they called to Lot and said to him, "Where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us that we may know them carnally." I'm reading out of the New King James. But this is how the NIV puts it. And I quote, "Bring them out to us so that we can have sex with them." That's what the NIV says. So you have young people, old people, and all the ages in between surrounding the house, and that's their intent. And Lot's wife says nothing. So Lot went to the door, went to them through the doorway, shut the door behind him, and he said, "Please, my brethren, do not do so wickedly. See now, I have two daughters who have not known a man." Virgins. And he says, "Let me bring them out to you so that you may do to them as you wish." That's hard to imagine. It's hard to fathom that a dad would say that about his daughters. And let them go out to these crazy animals to do whatever they want. And again, Lot's wife says nothing. "Since this is the reason they came under the shadow of my roof, only do nothing to these men." And they said in verse 9, "Stand back." Then they said, "This one came in to stay here, and he keeps acting as a judge. Now we will deal worse with you than with them. What is worse than being gang raped?" And again, Lot's wife says nothing. So they pressed hard against the man Lot, and they came near to break the door down. And Lot's wife says nothing. One of my favorite stories that my dad tells every once in a great while was when my mom and dad were in their apartment. And it was later in the evening. My mom was doing the dishes and cleaning up the kitchen. My dad had gone to bed. And then there was a knock at the door. So my mom naturally went over to the door, and their apartment door, from the floor to about midway to the door, it was wood, but then the top part of the door was a see-through glass. It's a window with a curtain over it. So naturally, my mom went over to the door. She pushed the curtain aside, and there was a man standing there. My mom's reaction, she just started screaming. And she was yelling and saying to my dad, "There's a man in the house. There's a man in the house." And my dad, who was in bed, every drop of adrenaline that was in his adrenal glands was dumped into his circulatory system. He jumped out of bed. He didn't even put his pants on or anything, and he just ran out into the front room. Well, obviously, there was nobody there, but my mom is screaming. She's saying, "There's a man. There's a man in the house." And he goes over to the door, moves the curtain aside, and it was a friend of the family that my mom didn't even recognize. It was an awkward situation for everybody. The point is, my mom said something. It was just an innocent knock. but she said something. And here in Genesis 19, we have animals that have surrounded their house with very terrible intentions. They threaten Lot. They're breaking the door down. And Lot's wife says nothing. Why is that? Maybe she was just not shocked anymore. Maybe she wasn't bothered one way or the other because she grew used to where she lived. Maybe she had become calloused to the things that she often saw by living and working in Sodom. Maybe because for everyone it was just an acceptable norm of society, the way people behaved. Maybe she thought, I'm okay. We're okay. We're comfortable. We have a home. We have a life here. And things are going pretty well for us physically. This will blow over and life goes on. God's people are not to be silent. Notice what we read in Ezekiel 8. A little background first. Ezekiel had a vision. He saw God. Let's break into verse 4 of Ezekiel 8, when he writes, "And behold, the glory of the God of Israel was there, like the vision that I saw on the plain. And he said to me, Son of man, lift your eyes now towards the north. And so I lifted my eyes towards the north. And there, north of the altar gate, was this image of jealousy in the entrance. Furthermore, he said to me, Son of man, do you see what they're doing? The great abominations that the house of Israel commits here to make me go far away from my sanctuary. Now turn again, and you will see greater abominations." And verse 7, he brought me to the door of the court. And when I looked there, there was a hole in the wall. And he said to me, Son of man, dig. And when I dug, there was a door. And he said to me, go in and see the wicked abominations which they are doing there. So I went in, and I saw in there every sort of creeping thing, abominable beast, and all the idols of the house of Israel portrayed all around on the walls. And two more times, God says to him, I will show you even greater abominations than these. As he sees that. And then God says this in verse 17. And he said to me, have you seen this, O son of man? Is it a trivial thing to the house of Judah to commit the abominations which they commit here? For they have filled the land with violence. They have returned to provoke me to anger, and indeed they put the branch to their nose. Therefore I will act in fury. My eye will not spare, nor will I have pity. And though they cry in my ears with a loud voice, I will not hear them. Then, chapter 9, verse 1. He called out in my hearing with a loud voice, saying, let those who have charge over the city draw near, each with a deadly weapon in his hand. And suddenly 6 men came from the direction of the upper gate, which faces north, each with his battle axe in his hand. When one man among them was clothed with linen and had a writer's inkhorn at his side, and they went and stood beside the altar. Now the glory of the God of Israel had gone up from the cherub where it had been to the threshold of the temple, and he called to the man clothed with linen who had the writer's inkhorn at his side. And the Lord said to him, go through the midst of the city, through the midst of Jerusalem, and put a mark on the foreheads of the men who sigh and cry over all the abominations that are done within it. Those that sighed and cried would be spared the slaughter. God's people are not to be silent. Lot's wife did not sigh or cry. Do we? We live in Sodom. Have you seen enough? Have you heard enough? And have you experienced enough of this society? And we don't cry out? We don't sigh and cry? Matthew 6. What are we to cry out about to God? Matthew 6. In verse 10, three words from Jesus Christ. That when we pray, we are to pray, "Your kingdom come." The truth is, we don't belong in this world. Just like Lot's wife didn't belong in Sodom. We belong in the world that's coming. And when we see what's going on out in this world, the harm, the pain, the suffering, how can we be silent? What does it show God about where our affection is, our care and concern? And how can we be silent? We've just come from the Feast of Tabernacles, which God has given us to keep so that we can have a taste of the world that's coming, of abundance, a time of health and prosperity. And then we come back to real life and we see how backwards, how crazy, how stupid, and how awful it is. Are we sighing and crying in front of God, praying diligently, wholeheartedly, "Your kingdom come"? Because it will mean so much, not just to us, but to all the people that live on this planet. Hebrews 13. In verse 14, it says, "For here we have no continuing city." That's true. We can move to another city. We're still living in Sodom, though. You can move out into the country. You can have no neighbor from 100 miles to your house, but we still live in Sodom. But we seek the one to come. There is no place to go and nowhere to move. We're still in this awful society. We are to have no part of it. Jesus Christ said, "Remember Lot's wife." She said nothing. All that she saw, all that she heard, and where she lived, and she says nothing. We can't be that way. Let's go back to Genesis 19 and pick up another point. Let's reread verse 9. "And they said, 'Stand back.' Then they said, 'This one came in to stay here, and he keeps acting as a judge. Now we will deal worse with you than with them.' So they pressed hard against the man Lot and came near to break down the door. But the men," these were the angels, "reached out their hands and pulled Lot into the house with them and shut the door. And they struck the men who were at the doorway of the house with blindness, both small and great, so that they became weary trying to find the door." Do you see these animals? Even when they're struck with blindness, they're still desirous to attack those men in a sexual nature. Even though they can't see, they're that depraved. And they just won't quit in the ways of sin. "Then the men said to Lot," in verse 12, "'Have you anyone else here? Son-in-law, your sons, your daughters.'" You know what's interesting to me? They don't mention Lot's wife. One of the most important things to a man is his wife. A wife is important. But in the order that the angels speak, it's son-in-law, your sons, your daughters, and then they say, "whomever you have in the city." Like the least important one. Take them out of this place. For we will destroy this place because the outcry against them has grown great before the face of the Eternal, and the Eternal has sent us to destroy it. That's how bad it was. So Lot went out and he spoke to his sons-in-law who had married his daughters, and he said, "Get up, get out of this place, for the Lord will destroy this city." But to his sons-in-law, he seemed to be joking. They saw no need to leave. No reason. What they experienced, what they saw, what they heard was okay. Apparently. When the morning dawned, the angels urged Lot to hurry, saying, "Arise, finally." This is the first time that Lot's wife is mentioned. When the morning dawned, the angels urged Lot to hurry, and they said, "Arise, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, lest you be consumed in the punishment of the city." And while he lingered, they all lingered. What was it that was so important to do that they wouldn't get up and go? They put what was important to do, fleeing, running, on a back burner. They put what was important to do on that back shelf. What's on your shelf? What's on your back burner? You know what the easiest thing in the world to do? Is to put that issue or those issues on that shelf, on that back burner. We all have lingering issues. And every once in a while, whatever that issue or issues might be, they pop up. They come to the forefront, and the easiest thing to do is put it back on the shelf. Put it back on that burner. What is it that's so important to do that we won't get up and address it? Hebrews 12. In verse 1 we read, "Therefore we also, since we are surrounded by so great cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight." There are things that weigh down that shelf. "And the sin which so easily ensnares us." There are issues that simmer on that back burner. And he says, "Let us run. Let us run with endurance the race that is set before us." Isn't he saying address it? Isn't he saying deal with it? We can't afford to have lingering issues in our lives. We don't linger, brethren. We run. We have a goal, a great goal. We are to be focused, aggressive, and looking to that finish line. Looking to the return of Jesus Christ and what it will mean personally, where we can be changed. We will be born into the family of God. How can we let those things on the shelf, those things on the back burner, keep us from that? They have to be addressed. They have to be dealt with. Jesus Christ said, "Remember Lot's wife." They all lingered. They all had things apparently to do that was more important than to run for their lives. Back to Genesis 19. Let's look at another point. Let's pick it up in verse 16. "And while he lingered," brethren, the truth is they all lingered. The men took hold of his hand, his wife's hand, and the hands of his two daughters, because they just wouldn't get up and go. The Lord being merciful to him, merciful to his whole family. And they brought him out and set him outside the city. So it came to pass when they had brought them outside that he said, "Escape for your life. Do not look behind you, nor stay anywhere in the plain. Escape to the mountains, lest you be destroyed." Isn't there a sense of urgency there? Go. Run. Your lives are at stake. Run. But Lot says in verse 18, "Please, no, my lords. Please, no. I think if an angel came to my house, and there was no doubt in my mind it was an angel, and he said, 'You know what? We're going to destroy the city you live in. We have to destroy it. Run to Los Angeles.' I'm gone. You will see nothing but taillights." Now, I am a slow driver. My wife complains about that all the time. But if I have to drive to Los Angeles with my family, my foot will be right through the floorboard. I'm going to be gone. I'm not going to say, "Well, wait a minute, there's a much closer city I'd like to go to. I think Los Angeles is a little too far." Are you kidding me? Well, I said, "No. It's a little too far for us. A little too far to have your life spared." Even with all they were told, it doesn't seem that they have a sense of urgency about them. Is there a sense of urgency with us? Romans 13. This is what Paul says, beginning in verse 11. "And do this, knowing the time, that now it is high time to awake out of sleep." Is there a sense of urgency in what he's saying? Yes. He's saying, "Wake up. It's time to wake up. For now our salvation is nearer than when we first believed." It's that close. "The night is far spent, the day is at hand. Therefore, let us cast off the works of darkness and let us put on the armor of light. And let us walk properly, as in the day, not in revelry and drunkenness, not in lewdness and lust, not in strife and envy, but put on the Lord Jesus Christ and make no provision for the flesh to fulfill its lust." Is there a sense of urgency with us to address those items on the shelf, to deal with what is simmering on that back burner? Or is it better to address next month? Or next week? The sense of urgency is that it's now. Not tomorrow, not next week, now. Revelation chapter 1 and verse 3. Revelation 1 and verse 3, it says, "Blessed is he who reads and those who hear the words of this prophecy and keeps those things which are written in it." Why? For the time is near. It's that close. You know what it's all about for us? Change. Change is growth, and growth leads to maturity. If we're not serious about this, we won't be ready when Christ returns. And if we're not going to be ready when Christ returns, we won't be able to be in the family and kingdom of God. It's just that serious. And when Lot and his family had to flee. Apparently, it wasn't that serious, even though the angels had to drag them out of the house and tell them to run, but it was too far for them. Is it too much work for you and for me to address what has to be addressed, to deal with what has to be dealt with? So we can see Jesus Christ eye to eye. Matthew 25. We'll break into this parable for the sake of time. Matthew 25. And we'll break into verse 6. This is a very well-known parable. Think about the sense of urgency that comes upon the unwise virgins. Matthew 25, beginning in verse 6, and at midnight a cry was heard, "Behold, the bridegroom is coming, go out to meet him." Then all those virgins arose and trimmed their lamps, and the foolish said to the wise, "Give us some of your oil, for our lamps are going out." We're in trouble. We need help. And the wise ones say, "No, lest there should not be enough for us and you, but go rather to those who sell and buy for yourselves." They sense a sense of urgency now, because the bridegroom is coming. And they realize that. And they realize they're not ready. And they just can't do it. And while they went to buy, the bridegroom came, and those who were ready went in with him to the wedding, and the door was shut. Afterward, the other virgins came, and they said, "Lord, Lord, open to us." But he says and answered, "Assuredly, I say to you, I do not know you." It was too late. That sense of urgency didn't come early enough for them to spend the time necessary to do what they had to do so they could be ready when that call came. Remember Lot's wife, Jesus says. Let's go back to the story and pick up another point. Genesis 19. Let's pick it up in verse 18. Then Lot said to them, "Please know, my lords." And he explains that he wanted to go to someplace a little bit closer. God's mercy is so deep that God grants it. And in verse 20 we read, "See now, this city is near enough to flee to, and it is a little one. Please let me escape there. Is it not a little one, and my soul shall live?" And the angel said to him, "See, I have favored you concerning this also, in that I will not overthrow this city for which you have spoken. Hurry, escape there." A sense of urgency is still in the air. "For I cannot do anything until you arrive there." Therefore, the name of the city was called Zoar. Then the Lord rained brimstone and fire on Sodom and Gomorrah from the Lord out of the heavens. And he overthrew those cities, all the plain, all the inhabitants of the cities, and what grew on the ground. But his wife looked back behind him, and she became a pillar of salt. What happened here? This is what the Jameson Fawcett Brown commentary says. She not only looked back, but actually turned back. The fatal effects of a too deeply rooted affection for worldly attractions and willful disobedience to divine instruction. She had the opportunity to come out of Sodom. She did with her feet, but her heart was still there. This is what Matthew Henry, in his commentary, he says, Lot's wife let her curiosity and her inordinate love for the things of Sodom caused her to disobey and look back. It was a fatal act. She had the opportunity to come out of Sodom, just like we have the opportunity to come out of this world. Revelation 18. Revelation 18. In verse 4, we read, And I heard another voice from heaven saying, Come out of her, my people. Come out of Sodom and Gomorrah, lest you share in her sins and lest you receive of her plagues. We are to come out of this world. We are to go forwards and not backwards. Lot's wife went backwards. And it's happened to our era of the church twice. The first time it happened, and Mr. Armstrong wrote extensively about this in 1978, 1979, 1980, and 81. He preached about it, and he often spoke and wrote at this time period about putting the church back on track because it had gone backwards in the 70s. He wrote in the February 19th, 1979 Worldwide News, where he talked about how the 70s was the liberal era of the church. He talked about in that article about his son who had surrounded himself with liberal ministers and they started to water down the doctrines of the church. And the church went backwards and not forwards. And Mr. Armstrong says that the growth that the church had of 30-35% for 30 years stopped. I remember Mr. Milner, who was, I believe, the associate pastor back in the Oakland congregation of Worldwide, where he said when he was at Ambassador College in the 70s, there was a time where the students had Christmas trees in the dorms. Not everybody, but some did. And nothing was said. Christmas trees in the dorm. That's how far backwards the church went. And it was changed. The second time, the church went backwards and not forwards, was after Mr. Armstrong died. And you know, at that time period, 1 or 2 years after his death, it wasn't a watering down of doctrine that occurred. It was a remove and replace with the evangelical doctrines. The Worldwide Church of God no longer has that name. And they are unidentifiable as God's people because of the doctrines and the practices that go on there. Our last night to be in Worldwide, it's supposed to be a night to be much remembered. We went to a winery. It was a beautiful winery. And there was quite a few of us there. After we had eaten and after we had dessert, the individual who had arranged the night to be at this particular restaurant at the winery said to me, he said, Albert, a few of us are going to go to the lounge and we'd like you to join us to smoke some cigars. This was at the night to be much remembered. Now, I was processing what I heard. I didn't say anything at first because it's just like, what did I just hear? How do you respond to that? What do you say? Well, obviously no, but I didn't say that because I'm still dealing with what I heard. And because I had paused in my response, he then began to say why there was nothing wrong with doing that. I just told Mary Beth, let's just go home. And I just told him, no. No thanks. I shouldn't have said thanks. And I wonder today if I just should have maybe dressed him down. maybe fought and defended how wrong your position is and how stupid and crazy are you. But I didn't say anything. And I regret that. Because maybe I should have. But that's what happened to the church. It went backwards and not forwards. I want to read to you. They're not my words. This is the book that Joseph Dikosha Jr. wrote, where he catalogs the church's change. And he paints it in this way. But what it is going backwards and not forwards. This is what he says on page 38. In the past, we practiced all the Old Testament laws of purity and therefore refused to eat the foods listed as unclean in Leviticus 11. Pork and shellfish and a myriad other foods were off limits. A big part of our waking out of sleep is that many people have felt tremendous liberation from the bondage of the past and have expressed a need to act in certain symbolic ways. For instance, after my dad gave his Christmas Eve sermon in 1994, some people went out immediately afterwards to a lobster dinner. It wasn't that they needed lobster. They wanted to make the statement, I'm not bound by this anymore. How times have changed. It's been fun for me to watch some of my closest associates, including Greg Albrecht and Mike Fazell, on this issue. One time, Greg and Mike and I were in a restaurant, and Mike said, I'm going to have a pepperoni pizza. I hope this doesn't offend you. This is symbolic for me. Symbolic that the Church of God is bigger than us. Greg and I looked at each other and said, hey, go for it, Mike. I've had lunch or dinner with several others who have ordered similar items. I don't know if they're eating these things just to see how I react or if they really want to enjoy the new experience. One friend, a longtime church member, ordered a plate of mussels. Every insect in the ocean was on his plate, and you know what? It really didn't trouble me at all. I've tasted shrimp, I've tasted pork, I've tasted just about everything now. And if the craving for pepperoni ever does strike, I can party just as hearty as my friend Mike, and God is pleased. That's going backwards, not forwards. That's going back into the world, not coming out of the world. 1 Peter, Jesus Christ said, remember Lot's wife. She was given the opportunity to escape Sodom, and she just couldn't let it go. Too attached to the physical things. Too attached to what Sodom had to offer. And she lost her life. 1 Peter. First Peter chapter 1, beginning in verse 13. Peter says, therefore, gird up the loins of your mind. It's about a right attitude, a humble, yielded attitude. Be sober and rest your hope fully upon the grace that is to be brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. And it's what we're looking forward to. As obedient children, he says in verse 14, not conforming yourselves to the former lusts as in your ignorance, but as he who called you is holy, you also be holy in all your conduct. Because it is written, be holy, for I am holy. Remember Lot's wife. We are to come out of the world, not go back into it. In any way, in any place. God is clear. We are his people. And it's even reflected in what we eat. We don't eat everything like the world does. The last point. Lot's wife had the opportunity to escape destruction, but she was too attached to Sodom, too attached to the physical things that she had, to fully leave. We in the church have the opportunity to escape the destruction that is coming. Revelation 3. Revelation 3. In verse 10, Jesus Christ says to our era of the church, "Because you have kept my command to persevere, I also will keep you from the hour of trial, which shall come upon the whole world to test those who dwell on the earth." Revelation 12. In verse 6, "Then the woman," speaking of the church, "fled into the wilderness where she has a place prepared by God." Lot and his family did not have a place prepared by God for them. They were told to flee. Just go. Go to the mountains. But the church has a place that God prepares for her. The love of God, the mercy of God. We are focusing on the spiritual things, not the physical. And yet God spares the life of his people physically, that they should feed her there 1,260 days for 3.5 years. A place that God prepared for the church, for the members of the church. Verse 14, "The woman was given 2 wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness to her place, where she's nourished." We're fed. I would think spiritually and physically. For 3.5 years. For a time and times and half a time from the presence of the serpent. Even protected from Satan. Luke 17. Life goes on, doesn't it? We're so attached to this physical life. We have homes. We look forward to retirement. We have cars. We have a routine. In the future, we have to make a decision. When that call comes to leave, we have to let go of everything and go. Lot's wife couldn't do that. Jesus Christ says, "Remember Lot's wife." Verse 26 of Luke 17, "And as it was in the days of Noah, so will also be in the days of the Son of Man. They ate, they drank, they married wives, they were given in marriage." Life goes on. It's the routine of life, the things of life, the cares, your job, school. "Until the day that Noah entered the ark and the flood came and destroyed them all. Likewise, as it was also in the days of Lot, they ate, they drank, they bought, they sold, they planted, they built." Life goes on. If it wasn't for God sending those angels, Lot and his family would not have a clue that they had to leave, that they had to flee. It seems that they kind of liked where they lived. Maybe they were comfortable. Maybe she liked her house and all the things that she had in it. It was hard for her to go. Will it be hard for you to go? How will we know it's time? You know, there have been people over the years that have concluded it's time to flee, and they've left. They've sold everything, got rid of everything, and they've moved to Israel. Well, they were wrong. Are we going to have a phone call that we're all going to get at the same exact time, saying the exact same thing? Will we hear a voice? Will we all have the same dream? I don't know the method or the signal. What I do know is that God is a God of decency and order. And if you look at the pattern of how God protected his people over the years, it will be crystal clear when we have to prepare and we have to go. You know, with Israel, all the events, God told Moses to tell his people, there's a promised land that I'm going to give you. They knew in advance they were going to be leaving. God destroyed the nation. They had the Passover, they spoiled the Egyptians, and they all left orderly. It was clear. Same with Noah. God told him to build an ark. He was going to send a flood. The animals came, the ark was built, the family went in and God shut the door, and then the rain came. It was clear. And with Lot, God sent two angels to take them out. It was clear. When the Jerusalem church fled to Pella, it was clear. Tradition states that before the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70, the Jerusalem church had been miraculously warned to flee to Pella. This is what Epiphanius, a church writer in the 4th century, says, and I quote, "For when the city was about to be captured and sacked by the Romans, all the disciples were warned beforehand by an angel to remove from the city, doomed as it was to utter destruction. On migrating from it, they settled at Pella, the town already indicated across the Jordan." Eusebius, a 3rd century church historian, writes, and he says that as the Romans were approaching the city, and I quote, "The people belonging to the church at Jerusalem had been ordered by an oracle revealed to approved men on the spot before the war broke out to leave the city and dwell in a town called Pella." For us, it will be clear. The question is not, what's the signal? What's the exact time to go? It will be clear. The question is, can we leave everything behind and go? Lot's wife couldn't. Our lives are meshed in the society in so many ways. Maybe at that time in the future, your house will be perfectly the way you wanted it, decorated just right. You just finished putting in that brand new kitchen and bathroom, the new roof, the addition, the yard is right, you just bought that new car, whatever. And then we realize it's time to go. Lot's wife couldn't. She left with her feet, but her heart was still there in Sodom. Are we too wrapped up and our careers, or our jobs, our physical life, our physical things? Are we too comfortable living in this society to let it all go and flee? Are you willing to let go of everything physical that you have and go when that day comes? Recognize that everything we have, absolutely everything we have, is a gift from God. We don't embrace all these physical things as if it is an end-all, be-all. I want to go back to Hebrews 13. Verse 14 says, "For here we have no continuing city. We live in Sodom and Gomorrah." No matter what city we might decide to move to, it can be more conservative, Republican, religious, it's still Sodom and Gomorrah. Where's our affection? Where's our heart? Where's our attention and our hope? Is it to make the best we can and try and live in this physical world and life? Or is it something greater? that we look and hope and pray for. And that's the return of Jesus Christ, the setting up of the world tomorrow and his kingdom and being a part of it. For here we have no continuing city. That is true. We don't, because we don't belong in this world. We don't belong in this society. We belong in the society and the world that's coming, the one that Jesus Christ is bringing. I want to conclude with this. If you're seeking life, remember Lot's wife.